Cool. Everyone can hear me?
Okay.
So first, let me thank organizers for putting up this wonderful conference. And today I'm going to tell you some unpublished work on interacting 3D fermion ISPTs, which was done mainly with Chen Jiewang, and some preliminary results was also put up in the archive preprint last year. Okay, so well, this periodic table of non-interacting fermions is hardly a surprise for anybody by now, but it's really a remarkable achievement in this endeavor of classifying topological quantum matters. So we have, you know, these tenfold ways and symmetry classes. But if you look at table, the first thing one may notice is that only anti-unitary symmetries matters when you, well, in the labels of these 10 symmetry classes. None of the unitary symmetries enters the table. And there's, of course, a good reason for that. And the reason is that if you have a unitary symmetry, for example, some Z2 onsi symmetry, so I only mean onsi symmetries in this talk, then we can diagonalize Hamiltonian in a very simple way, or block diagonalize. So since this is non-interacting fermions, we can always write my many-body Hamiltonian in terms of, you know, psi dagger psi, and with a single particle, well, psi dagger single particle matrix H and psi, and this H is a single particle Hamiltonian. And if I have a Z2 symmetry, I can organize my psis into this kind of block form where I have the first block, all the components transforming non-trivially under the Z2 symmetry, and the second block, those components transforming trivially under the block, under the Z2 symmetry. And then the single particle Hamiltonian will also be block diagonalized because of the symmetry, you cannot mix psi plus with psi minus. And within each block, there are no more constraints coming from the unitary symmetry itself. And then basically, if you don't have any other symmetries, the problem reduces to that of a class D. No, basically, there's no other symmetries except the party hole symmetry. And then we have a Z2 class classification in one dimension, which is a G-type chain, and the Z classification in two dimensions, which are P plus IP superconductors and many copies of that. And then in three dimensions, we don't get anything. So, and this argument can be basically generalized to any other unitary symmetries, discrete symmetries, just to be concrete. Now, once the non-interacting fermions are more or less understood, a very natural direction is to understand the effect of interactions in this classification. And thanks to many people in this audience, now I think it's fair to say that we have a pretty good understanding of what's going on, at least for those faces in the periodic table. So for example, the one-dimensional BDI class, which has a Z classification, reduces to Z of 8 once you turn on interactions. And the same happens to a D3 class, you know, time-reversal invariant topological superconductors in three dimensions. You start from Z for non-interacting fermions, and it becomes Z of 16 once interactions are added. And for the topological insulators, which is this class, the story is slightly different. You have, well, we know there's a Z2 classification, but now once you add interactions, you actually get three Z2s, you get three, well, you actually get seven more faces. And the other Z2s are generated by essentially bosonic SPTs, which can only exist with interactions because you have to bind electrons into, you know, molecules, or you have to turn them into spins. And that can not be done without interactions. And there's a similar story for unitary symmetries. For example, in two dimensions, if you start from Z2 symmetry, which has a Z classification, and interactions break it down to Z of 8. Not really break it down, collapses to Z of 8. So to summarize, interactions can, I mean, the most common thing it can do is to reduce the non-interacting classifications, or it can enable bosonic symmetry protected faces by binding fermions into molecules, or, you know, turning them into spins. However, a somewhat less explored possibility is to ask whether interactions can introduce new fermionic faces, which are neither one of the non-interacting states nor a bosonic SPT face. So if you passed by Chen Jie's poster yesterday, you may have heard some examples in lower dimensions, in one dimension and two dimensions, where you need to have a Z4 fermion symmetry, fermion number conservation. Basically, fermion numbers have to be conserved, Mod 4. And in this talk, well, I mean, this list of references is by no means complete. In this talk, I'm going to tell you about example, which I think is interesting, in three dimensions. But the symmetry is somewhat unusual. You need a Z2 cross Z4 symmetry. This is not including the fermion parity symmetry. So the first thing you may ask is why I need this complicated looking symmetry to get anything interesting. And why is Z2 cross Z4, not Z2 cross Z2? So hopefully by the end of talk, I can explain all these. And before I get into the details, let me first tell you how we should think about this space, how we should look at this space. So imagine, well, this is 3D bulk. And of course, we want to have surface. And then let's imagine breaking the Z4 symmetry, no, this Z4 symmetry on the surface. So there's some kind of Z4 order parameter, which I denote by phi. And this is Z4, so it's kind of a clock variable that can take four different values. On the left-hand side, I have just say it's 1. And on the right side, the value is set to I. And then there's a Z4 domain wall between these two different domains. And it turns out that this phase will have a gapless mode running along the domain wall, which is protected by symmetry. So for those who are really careful, the symmetry, the actual symmetry of a system is actually parity times these two symmetries. And we can actually be a little more specific about what's going on the domain wall. So effective Lorentz theory for the domain wall is basically a one-dimensional kind of helical Dirac fermions. You have a right-moving and left-moving modes. And of course, this is nothing special. But then the Z2 symmetry, which is not broken, acts chirally on these two modes. So for example, the right moving electrons don't transform, or transform non-trivially under Z2, and the left moving ones don't transform. So this particular assignment of symmetry kills all the mass terms you can write down in this Lorentz effective field theory. For example, psi dagger right times psi left breaks the symmetry, and the same to the pairing term. And you can actually recognize that this is the boundary of 2D SPT, fermion SPT, protected by the Z2 symmetry. So imagine you extend this domain wall into the bulk. There, in some sense, there is a Z2 fermion SPT on the domain wall. Now, for the rest of the talk, I only focused on the abelian unitary symmetries. Okay, so how should we think about this question? Because we know that there are no non-interacting fermions, non-trivial phases to begin with, so you have to really have some ways to think about interacting phases. And well, as you probably have seen several times during the conference, once you have a unitary symmetry, you should just gauge it. And it's such a powerful idea that almost become an instinctive thing to do once you have a unitary symmetry at hand. So okay, let's do it. So, well, but no, before I go to 3D, let me first tell you what I actually mean by gauge global symmetry. Apologize for those of you who have known this very well and probably too much. So let's consider a 3D BCS superconductor. And it's, let's say, just S-wave superconductor, gapped S-wave trivial superconductor. And if you look at the bulk, the excitations can be classified, I mean, topologically into Couple pairs. I mean, these are the ground state. And Bogoliubov quasi-particles. These are basically electrons and holes. Hamiltonian for superconductors is something of this form. You have C dagger C and C dagger C dagger in pairing terms. And of course, any fermion Hamiltonian has to conserve the parity symmetry. You can only change fermion number by 2. This is a requirement of locality. Now, because you have a global symmetry, you can couple the system to a gauge field of that global symmetry. This is gauging. And what you get is a Z2 gauge theory. Of course, now in 3D, so the excitations are, because we have a Z2 gauge field, and these fermions are charged under Z2 symmetry. So we have some Z2 charge, which are fermions. And then we have pi fluxes. You know, these are basically the vortex in superconductors. But now, because we couple the superconductor to a gauge field, they become deconfined flux excitations, which form loops in the bulk. And we can actually do this at the level of Hamiltonians by turning on lattice, turning on gauge fields on a lattice. And there's a canonical way to do it in Hamiltonian. This is known as a minimal coupling. And we can do it actually without really changing the low energy spectrum, just by introducing higher energy flux excitations. OK, so you can do this whenever you have a global symmetry, global unitary symmetry. This is the case for Fermi parity. So for unitary symmetries, we can understand classification by looking at what you get after you gauge the symmetry. So basically, SPT phases can be understood by topological properties of symmetry fluxes. So this is both a classification and also a characterization of the phase. So let's consider an example, which actually is relevant to what I'm going to talk about. So consider a 2D example where you have two layers of topological superconductors. And you've seen this in Fiona's talk yesterday. So the first layer is a P plus IP, or n copies of that. And the second layer is P minus IP, also n copies of that, just to have no chiral edge modes. And the symmetry is simply the conservation of Fermi parity in one of the layers. And it could be any of them. And so with this symmetry, there are actually gapless Majorana edge modes, because the backscattering between them is also forbidden by the symmetry. So now if we gauge it, we don't really have to gauge it entirely. We just have to introduce some pi fluxes. And imagine there's some kind of static gauge fields in the background. So if n is odd, remember that the symmetry is just the conservation of Fermi parity in one of the layers. So introducing symmetry flux is just putting a vortex into one of the layers. So let's put it into the first layer. And then if n is odd, we just have a vortex in the P plus IP, or odd number of copies of that. And we know that this flux has a Majorana zero mode in it. So it's a non-abelian excitation, in a sense. And that means this is definitely non-trivial. And if the n is even, you have even number of Majorana zero modes, you can actually, and they don't really give you any non-abelian properties. But then you can look at the topological spin. I mean, this is really just imagine you twist this object by 2 pi, and you get a phase. And because this is really a Z2 defect, so the square of this quantity is meaningful, and you get e to the I pi n over 4. It tells you that if n is 8, you get 1. So that explains the Z8 classification of this guy. So now we are going to apply the same idea to 3D. And first, this was explained in the paper by Michael and Zhen Chen. So first, let's just try to understand excitations in the gauge system in 3 dimensions. And as I said, I'm only going to talk about abelian unitary symmetries in this talk. So for abelian finite group, you can always write it as a product of some cyclic groups, so Z of something, Z of n of I. And once you gauge it, once you gauge all the symmetry, is there a question or no? Once you.
I guess I'm watching the abelian unitary.
What's abelian unitary symmetry?
What's
non-unitary. So non-unitary symmetry will be something like time reversal.
Versus
anti-unitary. No, sorry, I didn't probably define it. Anyway, so if we gauge all the symmetries you have, this symmetry plus a Fermi parity conservation, you get a gauge theory with this gauge group. You have Z2, which is a Fermi parity, and I put F just to indicate that the gauge charge of this guy is fermionic. And the rest of it is just some gauge group. And the charge of this part of the gauge group are all bosonic. And now, excitations can be labeled by this is a gauge theory, abelian gauge theory, so you have some charge excitations, and you can label it by a vector Q, which just tell you, you know, how many gauge charge you have for each component. And you also have a vortex or flux excitations, and you can also label them by a vector, which tell you how much gauge flux it carries for each of these components. So you have all these different excitations in the bulk. And again, let's look at braiding statistics in 3D. Well, we know that for charges, the point-like particles, you have fermion bosons, and that's it. So, and in particular, we know that the statistics of a gauge charge is just determined by the number of the fermionic gauge charge you have. So it's minus 1 to Q0. Q0 is that number. So I'll use 0 to indicate this Z2F component of the gauge group. And then you can take a charge around a flux, and this is Aronson-Bohm effect. And you pick up a phase. Sorry, I use the same theta on both sides, but you know what I mean. So you get Q times phi. That's a phase you pick up once you do this. Okay, so well, these are not that interesting, but now we can also consider braiding statistics between fluxes. So imagine you have two fluxes, and the first thing you can do is just to imagine, you know, contracting one of them, I mean, a little bit, and then thread it through the other, bring it back while you have to enlarge it to bring it back. And this braiding statistics was argued by Chen Ji and Michael that it doesn't give you anything interesting. But then the basic reason that you can shrink this flux to a point, and then all you get is the braiding statistic between a particle and the loop. So to prevent this from happening, you really have to do this. You have to insert another flux inside. And now you cannot shrink these flux loops to a point. So this is the basic setup, and it's named three-loop braiding, is that you have a base loop, and you have two other loops linked to the base loop. And now you can braid these two loops. And this result is non-trivial. So let's introduce some notations, because I mean this is an abelian gauge group, so I can just think about these different components. So I have a K base loop and I have I of J. I braid I and J, and I will introduce these invariants, so-called topological invariants for the braiding, because you can alter the result of braiding by just attaching some gauge charge to loops, and to remove the ambiguity. The best thing to do is to just multiply the result of braiding by some integers, and this n ij is just the least common multiplier of ni and nj. And there's a similar quantity, sorry, I'm just too lazy to draw it. A similar quantity is that you have two identical gauge fluxes linked to a third one, and you can exchange them. So similarly, you have exchange statistics in two dimensions. Now you have a similar quantity in three dimensions, then you multiply by n of I. And these quantities are invariant, independent of charge attachment. So how do we compute these quantities? And this is done by a trick called dimensional reduction. So imagine you have a 3D bulk, you have some charges, and you have a flux excitations. And now let's put this system on a manifold, which is a two-dimensional surface cross S1. So it's some kind of solid torus, if you want. Now we can squeeze a third direction, the S1 direction. And so there's a periodic boundary condition here. You can squeeze the third direction all the way that it becomes just small compared to the linear size of M. And you can really think of this as a quasi two-dimensional system. So if you have a flux which goes all the way around, it becomes a particle, in a sense, in this two-dimensional system. And this gauge charge remains. So this way, you go from a 3D system to 2D system, I mean, the very natural way. But now with flux excitations, you can do something more. So you can put a flux membrane in the transverse direction. And what it really means is that if you take your gauge charge around, you'll pick up a phase. So it has to go across this membrane, and it will pick up some phase, just like what happens when it goes around to flux loop excitation. And you can still dimensionally reduce it to a 2D system, and you'll get some 2D topological phase. So basically, yeah, it's a branch cut. Yeah, basically, right. You can create this membrane by inserting the flux. So with this picture, we can compute the three-loop braiding statistics by basically applying the dimensional reduction to the braiding process. And you can imagine you have a braiding, you have a base loop and two other loops linked to the base loop, and then they can be really deformed into a process of braiding two flux with a background membrane, and the difference between this process and the same or the opposite process without the membrane, because really you have no flux going in and out. But the basic point is that you have a three-dimensional topological order, you can apply this dimensional reduction argument, and you get a bunch of two-dimensional topological orders associated to each base loop. So that's, I'm not claiming that this is all you get in 3D, but this is at least something we can look at. So the example of, so by thinking about this braiding process, you can distinguish different bosonic SPT phases. This was demonstrated by Chen Ji and Michael. So for example, for Zn cross Zn bosonic SPTs, you have two gauge groups. You can think about all possible combinations of them, and that's four of them, and you have different phases. This was calculated from the lattice model. Now we're going to apply the same idea to fermionic phases, but you can just try to construct some lattice models and compute, but probably a better way is to think about it a little more before you compute, and it turns out that there you can derive many constraints on these abelian loop braidings without computing anything. So there are all a set of constraints for bosonic ones. Well, there are some of them are really simple. It's like ij is same as ji. It's pretty obvious. But these constraints apply to both bosonic and fermionic systems with very tiny modification. However, there are a couple of new constraints you get for fermionic systems. So these are both new constraints and replacing some of the constraints you get in bosonic systems. So for example, you have this condition, and you also have a condition coming from the requirement that you cannot have any chiral edge modes on the flux loops. So instead, these are really 2D constraints because we don't really do anything to the base loop. So now we have all these constraints. So if you're interested, I have slides for the derivation of these two. I can show if anyone's curious. And then we can just go and solve them, fix a gauge group, solve for just look for all solutions of these constraints. And if you get some interesting solution that may tell you that you have a non-trivial phase. Okay, so what do we get? We also have to pay special attention to a fermion parity flux, because in the fermionic systems, the fermion parity flux is special. So first thing you may ask is there any protected edge modes on the fermion parity flux? And for example, in this class D3 topological superconductor, there are gapless helical Majorana modes running on the flux. And this figure is taken from Xiaoliang Qi's paper. And you may ask whether you have anything similar in bosonic systems. And turns out that, and this is not the case, the fermion parity flux are always gapped. There are no gapless edge modes you can ever find on this fermion parity flux, which I draw as a blue one here. So you can show that all the invariants are completely trivial once you have fermion parity flux as a base loop. So there are no gapless modes if you're in the SPT phase. But then the only non-trivial invariant associated to fermion parity flux are this one. So you have a symmetry flux, not a fermion parity flux at the base loop, and you can braid fermion parity flux around the other guy, some other symmetry flux. And it turns out that this can only take value 0 to pi. And if it's 0, actually means that this is secretly a bosonic symmetry protective phase. There are the fermions don't really play any role. If it's pi, which is not allowed in a bosonic system, because it's equal to this quantity, which is zero, strictly zero in bosonic systems, then you really have an interacting fermion SPT, which cannot be connected to any bosonic SPTs. And also, you need I and j not equal. So that's why you need to consider something like z of 2 cross z of 4, like I said earlier. So now we can just enumerate, starting from the simplest symmetry group, z of n, and then you can just prove that all invariants are trivial. You don't get anything. Now, a simplest non-trivial case arises once you consider this guy. So you can also see that if you have z2 cross z2, you get nothing, except the bosonic ones. Now, with this particular group, you can have non-trivial invariants, in particular, this quantity is pi, indicating that this is really interacting fermion SPTs, and you don't find it in bosonic systems. And you can translate all these loop rating results into, you know, domain walls, and what you get is a picture that I told you earlier in the talk. Okay, so we have these constraints, good, but now the question is, are they complete? Do we miss anything? Maybe they are not a complete set of constraints, and these solutions are secretly wrong in some way. And well, we don't really have a proof that constraints are complete, but we can what we can do is to show that these solutions do arise in some lattice models, physical lattice models, and then we can be sure that these are physical. So I'm going to very briefly talk about a topological field theory for this particular phase, and this field theory was really well studied actually earlier by Anton and Ryan. This could call it two-group gauge theory. So, so this is a state-sum model, meaning that you first triangulate your space-time. So we're defining theory as a particular function on space-time, some kind of pass integral for discretized space-time. And you discretize the space-time into some four simplices, I mean, just no, a four-dimensional version of triangles and tetrahedrons. And for each so we attach some z2 variables to all the faces, and we attach the group variables to links. So you can imagine these are two-form gauge fields and one-form gauge field, the usual gauge field, just discrete versions of that. And they have to satisfy some constraints defined by a certain cohomology class taken from H of 3, G, and z2. And I mean, these are literally gauge fields, so they have to satisfy some kind of conditions which sets flux to zero, for example, for the one form and for the two form. And this is kind of twisted version of that. And now you can write down a partitioning function. So I'm not going to explain everything in the partitioning function, but there's something very well defined. You can write down and can in principle compute for any manifold, although it's in practice very complicated. However, we can still say many things about this theory. For example, this really is a Z2 cross G gauge theory, secretly. I mean, although you have some two-form gauge fields, but you can dualize it. And if we set G to trivial, this model reduces to a special case of the Kring-Yeta TKFT, which was also known in this community as a walk-over model. The Hamiltonian version of that is a walk-over model. So if we turn off all the Gs, the partitioning function becomes very simple. You just have this, and this is a cut product of F and F, for those who knows. And if you write a Hamiltonian for this guy, this is a fermionic 3D toric code studied by Kurt and Fiona a couple years ago. And there's a condition that has to be satisfied by these data. It's called obstruction vanishing condition, and this SQ means Stingel squared. But basically, this is the same condition you get from the supercohomology model studied by Zhen Chen and Xiao Gang. So we believe this is a gauged version of the Gu-Wen group supercohomology model. Basically, you take the supercohomology model and you gauge from parity, and this is what you should get. I mean, we don't have a proof, but I think it looks pretty convincing. So we can compute three loop ratings, some of them, not all of them, from dimensional reduction, basically. And I mean, those are those are where you have base loops carrying the fluxes of G, not the firm parity symmetry. So now we can just again carry out the calculations for each symmetries until we are really exhausted. So you can take G equals Zn. Again, you get no solutions at all, no interesting solutions at all. And this is in agreement with the previous argument. And for Z2 cross Z4, if you take the beta to take this particular form, you get a non-trivial solution. And this solution corresponds to the through-loop braiding that I told you earlier. And let me mention that if you're willing to take a more complicated group, you get more complicated braidings, and this is non-abelian, but this is actually the first case we look at. So anyway, so this is conclusion. I'm seeing I'm running out of time. And of course, there are many questions you can ask. For example, what are the constraints for non-abelian loop braiding, whether there are anything more interesting. For example, you have like Majorana-like objects once you have intersecting domains. And what are the surface topological orders for these fermionic symmetry protective faces? So thanks everybody for attention.
So I think you mentioned this in your first slide, the physical picture for this phase.
Yeah.
So it's taking the Z4 domain walls and adding one of these Z2 symmetry protected.
Yes, exactly. So you take Z4 domain walls and you add the n equals 2 case of the Z8 classification. And that's why you need Z4, because that guy is Z4 classified.
To make that a fermionic phase.
And this is the fermionic phase.
Right. So could the fermion parity be part of your symmetry? I mean, it's a little more natural if, let's say, the Z4 symmetry included the fermion parity, then it's like you broke down charge conservation to.
Yeah, you can also do that, but we actually, so all these arguments can be generalized to that case, but we don't really find anything interesting there.
But the phase survives. Let's say I had the Z4 to include fermion
parity. Yeah, so let's say you have Z4 firm parity across some Z2 symmetry, and we also have the constraints. We have constraints for the general case, but then we can solve the constraints there. All you get are bosonic faces.
Mm-hmm. So you need like a Z8 then, probably.
Z8 probably, but yeah.
So eventually, how do I see this? Actually, is does not have a free Fermi analog of this?
Yeah, there is no free Fermi analog.
So how do you prove that?
So
how do you prove that there's no free Fermi analog of this?
How do I construct the model or that?
No, but
it's just not free fermion.
But for tenfold weight table, they didn't consider Z2 cross Z4 at all, right?
Yeah, so because you can always diagonalize abelian symmetry, and the problem reduces to class D. And class D is trivial in 3D. So that's why you don't have a free fermion analog of this. I mean, the periodic table tells you the answer. It's just
class D, okay.
Yeah.
You said you're not sure about if you have all the constraints.
Yeah.
But what is even the definition of the constraints? In other words, are you assuming that the excitations are loop-like? For instance, you couldn't have a genus 2 excitation because that might entail new constraints.
So that's first of all, maybe some new breeding processes to think about. So far, I'm just restricting myself to through-loop breedings. But that doesn't mean that there are no other interesting processes that involves maybe heterogeneous surface of loops.
Oh, I didn't understand that. You're restricted to loops that are in exactly that configuration?
I'm thinking about braiding processes that involves loops exactly in that configuration.
Oh, I see.
And so far, these are the cases that we understand and seems to play a role in the classification of SPTs.
So if there was like a fourth loop, linking the horizontal loop, you have additional rules, additional constraints?
So just introducing more loops linked to the same base loop is not going to give you new constraints.
I see.
So you really have to think about some different configurations.
Like three hop links?
Three hop links or Borromean ring or something like that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
another question?
Okay. Could you explain the conjecture that was on one of your slides? You said capital theta II was zero.
Oh, yeah, sure. I tried to hide that. Apparently not hiding it very well. Okay. Oops, this is a slide. Yeah, so this remains a conjecture even for the bosonic phases, that we cannot quite prove theta of II is zero, but we can prove something weaker, for example, 3 times theta II equals 0. And if your symmetry, if n of I's are not multiple of 3, that implies this particular result. But then if, for example, your z or your ni's are 3, 6, then you cannot quite get to what we really want here. Yeah, this is exchange of two loops linked to a third one. And these and the loops you exchange and third one, the base loop, are the same loop, same type of loop.
In the bosonic case where things are captured by group cohomology, you can describe this dimensional reduction process as like a slash product.
Yeah.
Is there a similar thing here for group super cohomology?
Yeah, so what you do here is, let me get to a lattice model. So the data that you need in this lattice model is a three cocycle. So you can apply slam product to a three cocycle and get some two cocycle, and that describes a 2D phase. So that's how you go from 3D to 2D in this case.
Does that give you examples of things that cannot be captured by the dimensional reduction? Are there examples of 3D SPTs when you dimensionally reduce that just become trivial or collapse to the same SPT?
Not aware of any.
Okay.
So maybe I'll ask something that I've been sort of confused about for a while is, so
sure.
when you're doing this through the braiding, you're gauging the fermion parity symmetry. So what is fundamentally different about that symmetry being fermion parity as opposed to just having some extra ZT symmetry in the bosonic?
What's fundamentally different? Well, I mean, the obvious answer is that the charge is fermionic. And so, okay, so otherwise, I mean, there are, so I cannot come up with any more fundamental answer to that, but if you think about these constraints, so when we derive these constraints, involves like fusing loops to a charge, and that's where the difference comes in. So some of the things you can say, now you have to modify them. For bosonic ones, you have to modify, because the charge are fermionic, so. Yeah. So some of things have to be modified.
I have a related question to Hannah's question.
Yeah.
What are the essential properties of this 3D fermionic toric code? That is, somewhere you said there's a fermionic 3D toric code.
Yeah.
What are the differences between this and the bosonic toric code in 3D?
So one of them has bosonic charge and the other one has fermionic charge.
The gate charge.
Gate charge, yeah.
But we know that in boson systems, we can also create 3D topological order state where the point charge are fermion.
Oh, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So when I say fermionic toric code, I mean a toric code arising in a bosonic system, but charge is fermionic.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry for the confusion.
Is there a concern that some of the fermion phases might collapse after gauging fermion parity?
It's possible, but this case, things. Even after we gauge from parities, we can still see the non-trivial braiding. So at least it doesn't happen in this case. But I agree that it may happen.
Any further questions? Well, if not, let's thank Ken.